Tender is the Night, Disc 3.
13. Dick turned the corner of the traverse and continued along the trench, walking on the duckboard. He came to a periscope, looked through it a moment, then he got up on the step and peered over the parapet. In front of him, beneath a dingy sky, was Beaumont Hamel. To his left, the tragic hill of Thiepval. Dick stared at them through his field glasses, his throat straining with sadness. He went on along the trench and found the others waiting for him in the next traverse. He was full of excitement, and he wanted to communicate it to them, to make them understand about this, though actually Abe North had seen battle service and he had not. "This land here cost 20 lives a foot that summer," he said to Rosemary. She looked out obediently at the rather bare green plain with its low trees of 6 years' growth. If Dick had added that they were now being shelled, she would have believed him that afternoon. Her love had reached a point where now, at last, she was beginning to be unhappy, to be desperate. She didn't know what to do. She wanted to talk to her mother. "There are lots of people dead since, and will all be dead soon," said Abe consolingly. Rosemary waited tensely for Dick to continue. "See that little stream? We could walk to it in 2 minutes. It took the British a month to walk to it. A whole empire walking very slowly, dying in front and pushing forward behind. And another empire walked very slowly backward a few inches a day, leaving the dead like a million bloody rugs. No Europeans will ever do that again in this generation." "Why, they've only just quit over in Turkey," said Abe. "And in Morocco, that's different. This Western Front business couldn't be done again, not for a long time. The young men think they could do it, but they couldn't. They could fight the first Marne again, but not this. This took religion, and years of plenty and tremendous sureties, and the exact relation that existed between the classes. The Russians and Italians weren't any good on this front. You had to have a whole-souled, sentimental equipment going back further than you could remember. You had to remember Christmas, and postcards of the Crown Prince and his fiancée, and little cafés in Valence, and beer gardens in Unter den Linden, and weddings at the mairie, and going to the Derby, and your grandfather's whiskers. General Grant invented this kind of battle at Petersburg in 65. No, he didn't. He just invented mass butchery. This kind of battle was invented by Lewis Carroll and Jules Verne, and whoever wrote Undine, and country deacons bowling, and marraines in Marseille, and girls seduced in the back lanes of Württemberg and Westphalia. Why, this was a love battle. There was a century of middle-class love spent here. This was the last love battle. You want to hand over this battle to D.H. Lawrence," said Abe. "All my beautiful, lovely, safe world blew itself up here with a great gust of high, explosive love." Dick mourned persistently. "Isn't that true, Rosemary?"
"I don't know," she answered with a grave face. "You know everything."
They dropped behind the others. Suddenly a shower of earth gobs and pebbles came down on them, and Abe yelled from the next traverse, "The war spirit's getting into me again. I have 100 years of Ohio love behind me, and I'm going to bomb out this trench." His head popped up over the embankment. "You're dead. Don't you know the rules? That was a grenade." Rosemary laughed, and Dick picked up a retaliatory handful of stones and then put them down. "I couldn't kid here," he said rather apologetically. "The silver cord is cut, and the golden bowl is broken and all that, but an old romantic like me can't do anything about it."
"I'm romantic, too."
They came out of the neat, restored trench and faced a memorial to the Newfoundland dead.
Reading the inscription, Rosemary burst into sudden tears. Like most women, she liked to be told how she should feel. And she liked Dick's telling her which things were ludicrous and which things were sad. But most of all, she wanted him to know how she loved him. Now that the fact was upsetting everything, now that she was walking over the battlefield in a thrilling dream. After that, they got in their car and started back toward Amiens. A thin, warm rain was falling on the new scrubby woods and underbrush, and they passed great funeral pyres of sorted duds, shells, bombs, grenades, and equipment, helmets, bayonets, gun stocks, and rotten leather, abandoned 6 years in the ground. And suddenly, around a bend, the white caps of a great sea of graves. Dick asked the chauffeur to stop. "There's that girl, and she still has her wreath." They watched as he got out and went over to the girl, who stood uncertainly by the gate with a wreath in her hand. Her taxi waited. She was a red-haired girl from Tennessee, whom they had met on the train this morning, come from Knoxville, to lay a memorial on her brother's grave. There were tears of vexation on her face. "The War Department must have given me the wrong number," she whimpered. "It had another name on it. I've been looking for it since 2 o'clock, and there's so many graves."
"Then if I were you, I'd just lay it on any grave without looking at the name," Dick advised her.
"You reckon that's what I ought to do?"
"I think that's what he'd have wanted you to do." It was growing dark, and the rain was coming down harder. She left the wreath on the first grave inside the gate, and accepted Dick's suggestion that she dismiss her taxicab and ride back to Amiens with them. Rosemary shed tears again when she heard of the mishap. Altogether, it had been a watery day, but she felt that she had learned something, though exactly what it was, she did not know. Later, she remembered all the hours of the afternoon as happy, one of those uneventful times that seem at the moment only a link between past and future pleasure, but turn out to have been the pleasure itself. Amiens was an echoing purple town, still sad with the war, as some railroad stations were, the Gare du Nord and Waterloo Station in London. In the daytime, one is deflated by such towns, with their little trolley cars of 20 years ago crossing the great gray cobblestoned squares in front of the cathedral, and the very weather seems to have a quality of the past, faded weather, like that of old photographs. But after dark, all that is most satisfactory in French life swims back into the picture. The sprightly tarts, the men arguing with 100 voilas in the cafés, the couples drifting, head to head, toward the satisfactory inexpensiveness of nowhere. Waiting for the train, they sat in a big arcade, tall enough to release the smoke and chatter and music upward, and obligingly the orchestra launched into, "Yes, we have no bananas." They clapped because the leader looked so pleased with himself. The Tennessee girl forgot her sorrow and enjoyed herself, even began flirtations of tropical eye-rollings and pawings with Dick and Abe. They teased her gently. Then, leaving infinitesimal sections of Württembergers, Prussian guards, chasseurs alpins, Manchester mill hands, and old Etonians to pursue their eternal dissolution under the warm rain, they took the train for Paris. They ate sandwiches of mortadelle sausage and bel paese cheese made up in the station restaurant, and drank Beaujolais. Nicole was abstracted, biting her lip restlessly and reading over the guidebooks to the battlefield that Dick had brought along. Indeed, he had made a quick study of the whole affair, simplifying it always until it bore a faint resemblance to one of his own parties. When they reached Paris, Nicole was too tired to go on to the grand illumination at the decorative art exposition as they had planned. They left her at the Hotel Roi Georges, and as she disappeared between the intersecting planes made by lobby lights of the glass doors, Rosemary's oppression lifted. Nicole was a force, not necessarily well-disposed or predictable like her mother, an incalculable force. Rosemary was somewhat afraid of her. At 11, she sat with Dick and the Norths at a houseboat café just opened on the Seine. The river shimmered with lights from the bridges and cradled many cold moons. On Sundays, sometimes when Rosemary and her mother had lived in Paris, they had taken the little steamer up to Suresnes and talked about plans for the future. They had little money, but Mrs. Spears was so sure of Rosemary's beauty and had implanted in her so much ambition that she was willing to gamble the money on advantages. Rosemary, in turn, was to repay her mother when she got her start. Since reaching Paris, Abe North had had a thin, vinous fur over him. His eyes were bloodshot from sun and wine. Rosemary realized for the first time that he was always stopping in places to get a drink, and she wondered how Mary North liked it. Mary was quiet, so quiet, save for her frequent laughter, that Rosemary had learned little about her. She liked the straight, dark hair brushed back until it met some sort of natural cascade that took care of it. From time to time, it eased with a jaunty slant over the corner of her temple, until it was almost in her eye when she tossed her head and caused it to fall sleek into place once more. "We'll turn in early tonight, Abe, after this drink." Mary's voice was light, but it held a little flicker of anxiety. "You don't want to be poured on the boat."
"It's pretty late now," Dick said. "We'd all better go." The noble dignity of Abe's face took on a certain stubbornness, and he remarked with determination,
"Oh, no." He paused gravely. "Oh, no, not yet. We'll have another bottle of champagne."
"No more for me," said Dick.
"It's Rosemary I'm thinking of. She's a natural alcoholic. Keeps a bottle of gin in the bathroom and all that. Her mother told me."
He emptied what was left of the first bottle into Rosemary's glass. She had made herself quite sick the first day in Paris with quarts of lemonade. After that, she had taken nothing with them, but now she raised the champagne and drank at it.
"But what's this?" exclaimed Dick. "You told me you didn't drink."
"I didn't say I was never going to."
"What about your mother?"
"I'm just going to drink this one glass." She felt some necessity for it.
Dick drank, not too much, but he drank. And perhaps it would bring her closer to him, be a part of the equipment for what she had to do. She drank it quickly, choked, and then said,
"Besides, yesterday was my birthday. I was 18.
"Why didn't you tell us?" they said indignantly.
"I knew you'd make a fuss over it and go to a lot of trouble." She finished the champagne. "So this is the celebration."
"It most certainly is not," Dick assured her. "The dinner tomorrow night is your birthday party, and don't forget it. 18. Why, that's a terribly important age."
"I used to think until you're 18 nothing matters," said Mary.
"That's right," Abe agreed. "And afterward is the same way."
"Abe feels that nothing matters till he gets on the boat," said Mary. "This time he really has got everything planned out when he gets to New York." She spoke as though she were tired of saying things that no longer had a meaning for her. As if in reality the course that she and her husband followed, or failed to follow, had become merely an intention. "He'll be writing music in America, and I'll be working at singing in Munich, so when we get together again there'll be nothing we can't do." "That's wonderful," agreed Rosemary, feeling the champagne.
"Meanwhile, another touch of champagne for Rosemary. Then she'll be more able to rationalize the acts of her lymphatic glands. They only begin to function at 18.
Dick laughed indulgently at Abe, whom he loved.
and in whom he had long lost hope. "That's medically incorrect, and we're going." Catching the faint patronage, Abe said lightly, "Something tells me I'll have a new score on Broadway long before you've finished your scientific treatise."
"I hope so," said Dick evenly. "I hope so. I may even abandon what you call my scientific treatise."
"Oh, Dick!" Mary's voice was startled, was shocked. Rosemary had never before seen Dick's face utterly expressionless. She felt that this announcement was something momentous, and she was inclined to exclaim with Mary, "Oh, Dick!"
But suddenly Dick laughed again, added to his remark, "Abandon it for another one," and got up from the table.
"But, Dick, sit down. I want to know—"
"I'll tell you sometime. Good night, Abe." "Good night, Mary."
"Good night, dear Dick."
Mary smiled as if she were going to be perfectly happy sitting there on the almost deserted boat. She was a brave, hopeful woman, and she was following her husband somewhere, changing herself to this kind of person or that, without being able to lead him a step out of his path, and sometimes realizing with discouragement how deep in him the guarded secret of her direction lay. And yet an air of luck clung about her, as if she were a sort of token.
XV. "What is it you're giving up?" demanded Rosemary, facing Dick earnestly in the taxi.
"Nothing of importance."
"Are you a scientist?"
"I'm a doctor of medicine."
"Oh," she smiled delightedly. "My father was a doctor, too. Then why don't you—"
She stopped. "There's no mystery. I didn't disgrace myself at the height of my career and hide away in the Riviera. I'm just not practicing." "You can't tell. I'll probably practice again someday." Rosemary put up her face quietly to be kissed. He looked at her for a moment as if he didn't understand. Then, holding her in the hollow of his arm, he rubbed his cheek against her cheek's softness, and then looked down at her for another long moment. "Such a lovely child," he said gravely. She smiled up at him, her hands playing conventionally with the lapels of his coat. "I'm in love with you and Nicole. Actually, that's my secret. I can't even talk about you to anybody because I don't want any more people to know how wonderful you are. Honestly, I love you and Nicole. I do." So many times he had heard this. Even the formula was the same. Suddenly she came toward him, her youth vanishing as she passed inside the focus of his eyes, and he had kissed her breathlessly as if she were any age at all. Then she lay back against his arm and sighed.
"I've decided to give you up," she said.
Dick started. Had he said anything to imply that she possessed any part of him? "But that's very mean," he managed to say lightly, "just when I was getting interested."
"I've loved you so." As if it had been for years. She was weeping a little now. "I've loved you so."
Then he should have laughed, but he heard himself saying, "Not only are you beautiful, but you are somehow on the grand scale. Everything you do, like pretending to be in love or pretending to be shy, gets across." In the dark cave of the taxi, fragrant with the perfume Rosemary had bought with Nicole, she came close again, clinging to him. He kissed her, without enjoying it. He knew that there was passion there, but there was no shadow of it in her eyes or on her mouth. There was a faint spray of champagne on her breath.
She clung nearer, desperately, and once more he kissed her and was chilled by the innocence of her kiss, by the glance that, at the moment of contact, looked beyond him out into the darkness of the night, the darkness of the world. She did not know yet that splendor is something in the heart. At the moment when she realized that and melted into the passion of the universe, he could take her without question or regret. Her room in the hotel was diagonally across from theirs and nearer the elevator. When they reached the door, she said suddenly, "I know you don't love me. I don't expect it, but you said I should have told you about my birthday. Well, I did, and now, for my birthday present, I want you to come into my room a minute while I tell you something. Just 1 minute." They went in, and he closed the door, and Rosemary stood close to him, not touching him. The night had drawn the color from her face. She was pale as pale now. She was a white carnation left after a dance. "When you smile," he had recovered his paternal attitude, perhaps because of Nicole's silent proximity, "I always think I'll see a gap where you've lost some baby teeth." But he was too late. She came close up against him with a forlorn whisper, "Take me." "Take you where?" Astonishment froze him rigid. "Go on," she whispered. "Oh, please go on, whatever they do. I don't care if I don't like it. I never expected to. I've always hated to think about it, but now I don't. I want you to." She was astonished at herself. She had never imagined she could talk like that. She was calling on things she had read, seen, dreamed through a decade of convent hours. Suddenly she knew, too, that it was one of her greatest roles, and she flung herself into it more passionately. "This is not as it should be," Dick deliberated. "Isn't it just the champagne? Let's more or less forget it."
"Oh, no. Now, I want you to do it. Now, take me. Show me. I'm absolutely yours, and I want to be."
"For one thing, have you thought how much it would hurt Nicole?"
"She won't know. This won't have anything to do with her,"
he continued kindly. "Then there's the fact that I love Nicole."
"But you can love more than just one person, can't you? Like I love Mother and I love you. More. I love you more now."
"The fourth place, you're not in love with me, but you might be afterwards, and that would begin your life with a terrible miss."
"No. I promise I'll never see you again. I'll get Mother and go to America right away."
He dismissed this. He was remembering too vividly the youth and freshness of her lips. He took another tone. "You're just in that mood."
"Oh, please, I don't care even if I had a baby. I could go into Mexico like a girl at the studio. Oh, this is so different from anything I ever thought. I used to hate it when they kissed me seriously."
He saw she was still under the impression that it must happen.
"Some of them had great big teeth, but you're all different and beautiful. I want you to do it."
"I believe you think people just kiss some way, and you want me to kiss you."
"Oh, don't tease me. I'm not a baby. I know you're not in love with me."
She was suddenly humble and quiet.
"I didn't expect that much. I know I must seem just nothing to you."
"Nonsense. But you seem young to me." His thoughts added, "There'd be so much to teach you." Rosemary waited, breathing eagerly, till Dick said, "And lastly, things aren't arranged so that this could be as you want." Her face drooped with dismay and disappointment. And Dick said, automatically, "We'll have to simply..." He stopped himself, followed her to the bed, sat down beside her while she wept. He was suddenly confused. Not about the ethics of the matter, for the impossibility of it was sheerly indicated from all angles, but simply confused. And for a moment his usual grace, the tensile strength of his balance, was absent.
"I knew you wouldn't," she sobbed. "It was just a forlorn hope."
He stood up.
"Good night, child. This is a damn shame. Let's drop it out of the picture."
He gave her two lines of hospital patter to go to sleep on.
"So many people are going to love you, and it might be nice to meet your first love all intact, emotionally, too."
"That's an old-fashioned idea, isn't it?" She looked up at him as he took a step toward the door. She looked at him without the slightest idea as to what was in his head. She saw him take another step in slow motion, turn and look at her again, and she wanted for a moment to hold him and devour him. Wanted his mouth, his ears, his coat collar. Wanted to surround him and engulf him. She saw his hand fall on the doorknob. Then she gave up and sank back on the bed. When the door closed, she got up and went to the mirror, where she began brushing her hair, sniffling a little. 150 strokes, Rosemary gave it, as usual. Then 150 more. She brushed it until her arm ached. Then she changed arms and went on brushing. 16. She woke up cooled and shamed. The sight of her beauty in the mirror did not reassure her, but only awakened the ache of yesterday. And a letter forwarded by her mother from the boy who had taken her to the Yale prom last fall, which announced his presence in Paris, was no help. All that seemed far away. She emerged from her room for the ordeal of meeting the divers, weighted with a double trouble. But it was hidden by a sheath as impermeable as Nicole's when they met and went together to a series of fittings. It was consoling, though, when Nicole remarked, apropos of a distraught saleswoman, "Most people think everybody feels about them much more violently than they actually do. They think other people's opinions of them swing through great arcs of approval or disapproval." Yesterday, in her expansiveness, Rosemary would have resented that remark. Today, in her desire to minimize what had happened, she welcomed it eagerly. She admired Nicole for her beauty and her wisdom, and also, for the first time in her life, she was jealous. Just before leaving Gosse's hotel, her mother had said in that casual tone which Rosemary knew concealed her most significant opinions that Nicole was a great beauty, with the frank implication that Rosemary was not. This did not bother Rosemary, who had only recently been allowed to learn that she was even personable, so that her prettiness never seemed exactly her own, but rather an acquirement, like her French. Nevertheless, in the taxi she looked at Nicole, matching herself against her. There were all the potentialities for romantic love in that lovely body, and in the delicate mouth, sometimes tight, sometimes expectantly half open to the world. Nicole had been a beauty as a young girl, and she would be a beauty later, when her skin stretched tight over her high cheekbones. The essential structure was there. She had been white Saxon blonde, but she was more beautiful now that her hair had darkened than when it had been like a cloud. And more beautiful than she. "We lived there." Rosemary suddenly pointed to a building in the Rue des Saints-Pères. "That's strange, because when I was 12, mother and baby and I once spent a winter there." And she pointed to a hotel directly across the street.
the two dingy fronts, stared at them, gray echoes of girlhood.
"We'd just built our Lake Forest house, and we were economizing," Nicole continued. "At least Baby and I and the governess economized, and Mother traveled."
"We were economizing, too," said Rosemary, realizing that the word meant different things to them.
"Mother always spoke of it very carefully as a small hotel." Nicole gave her quick, magnetic little laugh. "I mean, instead of saying a cheap hotel. If any swanky friends asked us our address, we'd never say. We're in a dingy little hole over in the Apache Quarter where we're glad of running water. We'd say, we're in a small hotel. As if all the big ones were too noisy and vulgar for us. Of course, the friends always saw through us and told everyone about it, but Mother always said it showed we knew our way around Europe. She did, of course. She was born a German citizen. But her mother was American, and she was brought up in Chicago, and she was more American than European."
They were meeting the others in 2 minutes, and Rosemary reconstructed herself once more as they got out of the taxi in the Rue Guynemer, across from the Luxembourg Gardens. They were lunching in the North's already dismantled apartment high above the green mass of leaves. The day seemed different to Rosemary from the day before. When she saw him face to face, their eyes met and brushed like birds' wings. After that, everything was all right. Everything was wonderful. She knew that he was beginning to fall in love with her. She felt wildly happy, felt the warm sap of emotion being pumped through her body. A cool, clear confidence deepened and sang in her. She scarcely looked at Dick, but she knew everything was all right. After luncheon, the divers and the Norths and Rosemary went to the Franco-American Films to be joined by Collis Clay, her young man from New Haven, to whom she had telephoned. He was a Georgian with the peculiarly regular, even stenciled ideas of Southerners who are educated in the North. Last winter she had thought him attractive. Once they held hands in an automobile going from New Haven to New York. Now he no longer existed for her. In the projection room she sat between Collis Clay and Dick while the mechanic mounted the reels of Daddy's Girl and a French executive fluttered about her trying to talk American slang. "Yes, boy," he said when there was trouble with the projector. "I have not any bananas." Then the lights went out. There was the sudden click and a flickering noise, and she was alone with Dick at last. They looked at each other in the half-darkness. "Dear Rosemary," he murmured. Their shoulders touched. Nicole stirred restlessly at the end of the row, and Abe coughed convulsively and blew his nose. Then they all settled down, and the picture ran. There she was, the schoolgirl of a year ago, hair down her back and rippling out stiffly like the solid hair of a Tanagra figure. There she was, so young and innocent, the product of her mother's loving care. There she was, embodying all the immaturity of the race, cutting a new cardboard paper doll to pass before its empty harlot's mind. She remembered how she had felt in that dress, especially fresh and new under the fresh young silk. Daddy's Girl. Was it a itty-bitty Bravekins, and did it suffer? Ooh, ooh, tweet, the tweetest thing, wasn't she des too tweet? Before her tiny fist, the forces of lust and corruption rolled away. Nay, the very march of destiny stopped. Inevitable became evitable. Syllogism, dialectic, all rationality fell away. Women would forget the dirty dishes at home and weep. Even within the picture, one woman wept so long that she almost stole the film away from Rosemary. She wept all over a set that cost a fortune, in a Duncan Fife dining room, in an aviation port, and during a yacht race that was only used in 2 flashes, in a subway, and finally in a bathroom. But Rosemary triumphed. Her fineness of character, her courage and steadfastness intruded upon by the vulgarity of the world, and Rosemary showing what it took with a face that had not yet become mask-like. Yet it was actually so moving that the emotions of the whole row of people went out to her at intervals during the picture. There was a break once, and a light went on, and after the chatter of applause, Dick said to her sincerely, "I'm simply astounded. You're going to be one of the best actresses on the stage." Then back to Daddy's girl. Happier days now, and a lovely shot of Rosemary and her parent, united at the last in a father complex so apparent that Dick winced for all psychologists at the vicious sentimentality. The screen vanished, the lights went on, the moment had come. "I've arranged one other thing," announced Rosemary to the company at large. "I've arranged a test for Dick."
"A what?"
"A screen test. They'll take one now."
There was an awful silence,
then an irrepressible chortle from the Norths. Rosemary watched Dick comprehend what she meant, his face moving first in an Irish way. Simultaneously she realized that she had made some mistake in the playing of her trump, and still she did not suspect that the card was at fault.
"I don't want a test," said Dick firmly. Then, seeing the situation as a whole, he continued lightly,
"Rosemary, I'm disappointed. The pictures make a fine career for a woman, but, my God, they can't photograph me. I'm an old scientist, all wrapped up in his private life."
Nicole and Mary urged him ironically to seize the opportunity. They teased him, both faintly annoyed at not having been asked for a sitting. But Dick closed the subject with a somewhat tart discussion of actors. "The strongest guard is placed at the gateway to nothing," he said. "Maybe because the condition of emptiness is too shameful to be divulged." In the taxi with Dick and Collis Clay, they were dropping Collis, and Dick was taking Rosemary to a tea from which Nicole and the Norths had resigned in order to do the things Abe had left undone till the last. In the taxi, Rosemary reproached him. "I thought if the test turned out to be good, I could take it to California with me, and then maybe, if they liked it, you'd come out and be my leading man in a picture." He was overwhelmed. "It was a darn sweet thought, but I'd rather look at you. You were about the nicest sight I ever looked at."
"That's a great picture," said Collis. "I've seen it 4 times. I know one boy at New Haven who's seen it 12 times. He went all the way to Hartford to see it 1 time. And when I brought Rosemary up to New Haven, he was so shy he wouldn't meet her. Can you beat that? This little girl knocks them cold."
Dick and Rosemary looked at each other, wanting to be alone, but Collis failed to understand.
"I'll drop you where you're going," he suggested. "I'm staying at the Lutetia."
"We'll drop you," said Dick.
"It'll be easier for me to drop you. No trouble at all."
"I think it will be better if we drop you."
"But,"
began Collis. He grasped the situation at last, and began discussing with Rosemary when he would see her again. Finally he was gone. With the shadowy unimportance but the offensive bulk of the third party. The car stopped unexpectedly, unsatisfactorily, at the address Dick had given. He drew a long breath. "Shall we go in?"
"I don't care," Rosemary said. "I'll do anything you want."
He considered. "I almost have to go in. She wants to buy some pictures from a friend of mine who needs the money." Rosemary smoothed the brief, expressive disarray of her hair. "We'll stay just 5 minutes," he decided. "You're not going to like these people." She assumed that they were dull and stereotyped people, or gross and drunken people, or tiresome, insistent people, or any of the sorts of people that the divers avoided. She was entirely unprepared for the impression that the scene made on her.
17. It was a house hewn from the frame of Cardinal de Ressa's palace in the Rue Monsieur, but once inside the door, there was nothing of the past, nor of any present that Rosemary knew. The outer shell, the masonry, seemed rather to enclose the future, so that it was an electric-like shock, a definite nervous experience, perverted as a breakfast of oatmeal and hashish, to cross that threshold, if it could be so called, into the long hall of blue steel, silver gilt, and the myriad facets of many oddly beveled mirrors. The effect was unlike that of any part of the decorative arts exhibition, for there were people in it, not in front of it. Rosemary had the detached, false, and exalted feeling of being on a set, and she guessed that everyone else present had that feeling, too. There were about 30 people, mostly women, and all fashioned by Louisa M. Alcott or Madame de Ségur. And they functioned on this set as cautiously, as precisely as does a human hand picking up jagged, broken glass. Neither individually nor as a crowd could they be said to dominate the environment, as one comes to dominate a work of art he may possess, no matter how esoteric. No one knew what this room meant because it was evolving into something else, becoming everything a room was not. To exist in it was as difficult as walking on a highly polished moving stairway, and no one could succeed at all save with the aforementioned qualities of a hand moving among broken glass, which qualities limited and defined the majority of those present. These were of two sorts. There were the Americans and English, who had been dissipating all spring and summer, so that now everything they did had a purely nervous inspiration. They were very quiet and lethargic at certain hours, and then they exploded into sudden quarrels and breakdowns and seductions. The other class, who might be called the exploiters, was formed by the sponges, who were sober, serious people by comparison, with a purpose in life and no time for fooling. These kept their balance best in that environment, and what tone there was, beyond the apartment's novel organization of light values, came from them. The Frankenstein took down Dick and Rosemary at a gulp. It separated them immediately, and Rosemary suddenly discovered herself to be an insincere little person, living all in the upper registers of her throat, and wishing the director would come. There was, however, such a wild beating of wings in the room that she did not feel her position was more incongruous than anyone else's. In addition, her training told, and after a series of semi-military turns, shifts, and marches, she found herself presumably talking to a neat, slick girl with a lovely boy's face, but actually absorbed by a conversation taking place on a sort of gunmetal ladder diagonally opposite her and 4 feet away. There was a trio of young women sitting on the bench. They were all tall and slender, with small heads groomed like mannequins' heads. And as they talked, the heads waved gracefully about above their dark tailored suits, rather like long-stemmed flowers and rather like cobras' hoods. "Oh, they give a good show," said one of them in a deep, rich voice. "Practically the best show in Paris. I'd be the last one to deny that. But after all," she sighed, "those phrases he uses over and over, oldest inhabitant gnawed by rodents, you laugh once." "I prefer people whose lives have more corrugated surfaces," said the second, "and I don't like her. I've never really been able to get very excited about them or their entourage either. Why, for example, the entirely liquid Mr. North?" "He's out," said the first girl. "But you must admit that the party in question can be one of the most charming human beings you have ever met." It was the first hint Rosemary had had that they were talking about the divers, and her body grew tense with indignation. But the girl talking to her, in the starched blue shirt with the bright blue eyes and the red cheeks and the very gray suit, a poster of a girl, had begun to play up. Desperately, she kept sweeping things from between them, afraid that Rosemary couldn't see her, sweeping them away until presently there was not so much as a veil of brittle humor hiding the girl. And with distaste, Rosemary saw her plain. "Couldn't you have lunch, or maybe dinner, or lunch the day after?" begged the girl. Rosemary looked about for Dick, finding him with the hostess to whom he had been talking since they came in. Their eyes met, and he nodded slightly, and simultaneously the three Cobra women noticed her. Their long necks darted toward her, and they fixed finely critical glances upon her. She looked back at them defiantly, acknowledging that she had heard what they said. Then she threw off her exigent vis-a-vis with a polite but clipped parting that she had just learned from Dick, and went over to join him. The hostess, she was another tall, rich American girl, promenading insouciantly upon the national prosperity, was asking Dick innumerable questions about Gose's hotel, whither she evidently wanted to come, and battering persistently against his reluctance. Rosemary's presence reminded her that she had been recalcitrant as a hostess, and glancing about, she said, "Have you met anyone amusing? Have you met Mr.—" Her eyes groped for a male who might interest Rosemary, but Dick said they must go. They left immediately, moving over the brief threshold of the future to the sudden past of the stone facade without. "Wasn't it terrible?" he said. "Terrible," she echoed obediently. "Rosemary," she murmured, what in an awed voice, "I feel terribly about this." She was shaken with audibly painful sobs. "Have you got a handkerchief?" she faltered. But there was little time to cry, and lovers now, they fell ravenously on the quick seconds, while outside the taxi windows the green and cream twilight faded, and the fire-red, gas-blue, ghost-green signs began to shine smokily through the tranquil rain. It was nearly six. The streets were in movement. The bistros gleamed. The Place de la Concorde moved by in pink majesty as the cab turned north. They looked at each other at last, murmuring names that were a spell. Softly the two names lingered on the air, died away more slowly than other words, other names, slower than music in the mind. "I don't know what came over me last night," Rosemary said. "That glass of champagne? I've never done anything like that before."
"You simply said you loved me."
"I do love you. I can't change that."
It was time for Rosemary to cry, so she cried a little in her handkerchief.
"I'm afraid I'm in love with you," said Dick. "And that's not the best thing that could happen."
Again the names. Then they lurched together as if the taxi had swung them, her breasts crushed flat against him, her mouth was all new and warm, owned in common. They stopped thinking with an almost painful relief, stopped seeing. They only breathed and sought each other. They were both in the gray, gentle world of a mild hangover of fatigue when the nerves relax in bunches like piano strings and crackle suddenly like wicker chairs. Nerves so raw and tender must surely join other nerves, lips to lips, breast to breast. They were still in the happier stage of love. They were full of brave illusions about each other, tremendous illusions, so that the communion of self with self seemed to be on a plane where no other human relations mattered. They both seemed to have arrived there with an extraordinary innocence, as though a series of pure accidents had driven them together, so many accidents that at last they were forced to conclude that they were for each other. They had arrived with clean hands, or so it seemed, after no traffic with the merely curious and clandestine. But for Dick, that portion of the road was short. The turning came before they reached the hotel. "There's nothing to do about it," he said, with a feeling of panic. "I'm in love with you, but it doesn't change what I said last night."
"That doesn't matter now. I just wanted to make you love me. If you love me, everything's all right."
"Unfortunately, I do. But Nicole mustn't know. She mustn't suspect, even faintly. Nicole and I have got to go on together. In a way, that's more important than just wanting to go on."
"Kiss me once more."
He kissed her, but momentarily he had left her. "Nicole mustn't suffer. She loves me, and I love her. You understand that?"
She did understand.
It was the sort of thing she understood well, not hurting people. She knew the divers loved each other because it had been her primary assumption. She had thought, however, that it was a rather cooled relation, and actually rather like the love of herself and her mother. When people have so much for outsiders, didn't it indicate a lack of inner intensity? "And I mean love," he said, guessing her thoughts. "Active love. It's more complicated than I can tell you. It was responsible for that crazy duel."
"How did you know about the duel? I thought we were to keep it from you."
"Do you think Abe can keep a secret?"
He spoke with incisive irony.
"Tell a secret over the radio, publish it in a tabloid, but never tell it to a man who drinks more than 3 or 4 a day."
She laughed in agreement, staying close to him.
"So you understand my relations with Nicole are complicated. She's not very strong. She looks strong, but she isn't. And this makes rather a mess."
"Oh, say that later. But kiss me now. Love me now. I'll love you and never let Nicole see."
"You darling."
They reached the hotel, and Rosemary walked a little behind him, to admire him, to adore him. His step was alert, as if he had just come from some great doings, and was hurrying on toward others. Organizer of private gaiety, curator of a richly encrusted happiness. His hat was a perfect hat, and he carried a heavy stick and yellow gloves. She thought what a good time they would all have being with him tonight. They walked upstairs, 5 flights. At the first landing, they stopped and kissed. She was careful on the next landing. On the third, more careful still. On the next, there were 2 more, she stopped halfway and kissed him fleetingly goodbye. At his urgency, she walked down with him to the one below for a minute, and then up and up. Finally, it was goodbye with their hands stretching to touch along the diagonal of the banister, and then the fingers slipping apart. Dick went back downstairs to make some arrangements for the evening. Rosemary ran to her room and wrote a letter to her mother. She was conscience-stricken because she did not miss her mother at all.
18. Although the divers were honestly apathetic to organized fashion, they were nevertheless too acute to abandon its contemporaneous rhythm and beat. Dick's parties were all concerned with excitement, and a chance breath of fresh night air was the more precious for being experienced in the intervals of the excitement. The party that night moved with the speed of a slapstick comedy. They were 12, they were 16, they were quartets in separate motors bound on a quick odyssey over Paris. Everything had been foreseen. People joined them as if by magic. accompanied them as specialists, almost guides, through a phase of the evening, dropped out, and were succeeded by other people, so that it appeared as if the freshness of each one had been husbanded for them all day. Rosemary appreciated how different it was from any party in Hollywood, no matter how splendid in scale. There was, among many diversions, the car of the Shah of Persia. Where Dick had commandeered this vehicle, what bribery was employed, these were facts of irrelevance. Rosemary accepted it as merely a new facet of the fabulous, which for 2 years had filled her life. The car had been built on a special chassis in America. Its wheels were of silver, so was the radiator. The inside of the body was inlaid with innumerable brilliants which would be replaced with true gems by the court jeweler when the car arrived in Tehran the following week. There was only one real seat in back, because the Shah must ride alone, so they took turns riding in it and sitting on the marten fur that covered the floor. But always there was Dick. Rosemary assured the image of her mother ever carried with her that never, never had she known anyone so nice, so thoroughly nice, as Dick was that night. She compared him with the two Englishmen, whom Abe addressed conscientiously as Major Hengist and Mr. Horsa, and with the heir to a Scandinavian throne, and the novelist, just back from Russia, and with Abe, who was desperate and witty, and with Collis Clay, who joined them somewhere and stayed along, and felt there was no comparison. The enthusiasm, the selflessness behind the whole performance ravished her. The technique of moving many varied types, each as immobile, as dependent on supplies of attention as an infantry battalion is dependent on rations, appeared so effortless that he still had pieces of his own most personal self for everyone. Afterward, she remembered the times when she had felt the happiest. The first time was when she and Dick danced together, and she felt her beauty sparkling bright against his tall, strong form as they floated, hovering like people in an amusing dream. He turned her here and there with such a delicacy of suggestion that she was like a bright bouquet, a piece of precious cloth being displayed before 50 eyes. There was a moment when they were not dancing at all, simply clinging together. Sometime in the early morning they were alone, and her damp, powdery young body came up close to him in a crush of tired cloth, and stayed there, crushed against a background of other people's hats and wraps. The time she laughed most was later when 6 of them, the best of them, noblest relics of the evening, stood in the dusky front lobby of the Ritz, telling the night concierge that General Pershing was outside and wanted caviar and champagne. "He brooks no delay. Every man, every gun is at his service." Frantic waiters emerged from nowhere, a table was set in the lobby, and Abe came in representing General Pershing while they stood up and mumbled remembered fragments of war songs at him. In the waiters' injured reaction to this anticlimax, they found themselves neglected. So they built a waiter trap, a huge and fantastic device constructed of all the furniture in the lobby and functioning like one of the bizarre machines of a Goldberg cartoon. Abe shook his head doubtfully at it.
"Perhaps it would be better to steal a musical saw and—"
"That's enough," Mary interrupted. "When Abe begins bringing up that, it's time to go home." Anxiously she confided to Rosemary, "I've got to get Abe home. His boat train leaves at 11. It's so important, I feel the whole future depends on his catching it, but whenever I argue with him, he does the exact opposite." "I'll try and persuade him," offered Rosemary. "Would you?" Mary said doubtfully. "Maybe you could." Then Dick came up to Rosemary.
"Nicole and I are going home, and we thought you'd want to go with us."
Her face was pale with fatigue in the false dawn. 2 wan dark spots in her cheek marked where the color was by day. "I can't,"
she said. "I promised Mary North to stay along with them, or Abe'll never go to bed. Maybe you could do something."
"Don't you know you can't do anything about people?" he advised her. "If Abe was my roommate in college, tight for the first time, it'd be different. Now there's nothing to do."
"Well, I've got to stay. He says he'll go to bed if we only come to the Isle with him," she said almost defiantly. He kissed the inside of her elbow quickly. "Don't let Rosemary go home alone," Nicole called to Mary as they left. "We feel responsible to her mother." Later, Rosemary in the Norths and a manufacturer of dolls' voices from Newark and ubiquitous Collis and a big, splendidly dressed oil Indian named George T. Horse Protection were riding along on top of thousands of carrots in a market wagon. The earth in the carrot beards was fragrant and sweet in the darkness, and Rosemary was so high up in the load that she could hardly see the others in the long shadow between infrequent street lamps. Their voices came from far off, as if they were having experiences different from hers, different and far away. For she was with Dick in her heart, sorry she had come with the Norths, wishing she was at the hotel and him asleep across the hall, or that he was here beside her with the warm darkness streaming down. "Don't come up," she called to Collis. "The carrots will all roll." She threw one at Abe, who was sitting beside the driver, stiffly like an old man. Later she was homeward bound at last in broad daylight, with the pigeons already breaking over Saint-Sulpice. All of them began to laugh spontaneously because they knew it was still last night, while the people in the streets had the delusion that it was bright, hot morning. "At last I've been in a wild party," thought Rosemary. "But it's no fun when Dick isn't there." She felt a little betrayed and sad. But presently a moving object came into sight. It was a huge horse chestnut tree in full bloom, bound for the Champs-Élysées, strapped now into a long truck and simply shaking with laughter, like a lovely person in an undignified position, yet confident nonetheless of being lovely. Looking at it with fascination, Rosemary identified herself with it, and laughed cheerfully with it, and everything all at once seemed gorgeous. Abe left from the Gare Saint-Lazare at 11. He stood alone under the fouled glass dome, relic of the 70s, era of the Crystal Palace. His hands, of that vague gray color that only 24 hours can produce, were in his coat pockets to conceal the trembling fingers. With his hat removed, it was plain that only the top layer of his hair was brushed back. The lower levels were pointed resolutely sidewise. He was scarcely recognizable as the man who had swum upon Gosa's beach a fortnight ago. He was early. He looked from left to right with his eyes only. It would have taken nervous forces out of his control to use any other part of his body. New-looking baggage went past him. Presently, prospective passengers with dark little bodies were calling, "Jewels, hoo-hoo," in dark, piercing voices. At the minute when he wondered whether or not he had time for a drink at the buffet, and began clutching at the soggy wad of 1,000-franc notes in his pocket, one end of his pendulous glance came to rest upon the apparition of Nicole at the stairhead. He watched her. She was self-revelatory in her little expressions, as people seem to someone waiting for them who as yet is himself unobserved. She was frowning, thinking of her children, less gloating over them than merely animally counting them, a cat checking her cubs with a paw. When she saw Abe, the mood passed out of her face. The glow of the morning skylight was sad, and Abe made a gloomy figure with dark circles that showed through the crimson tan under his eyes. They sat down on a bench.
I came because you asked me, said Nicole defensively.
Abe seemed to have forgotten why he asked her, and Nicole was quite content to look at the travelers passing by.
That's going to be the belle of your boat, that one with all the men to say goodbye. You see why she bought that dress?
Nicole talked faster and faster.
You see why nobody else would buy it except the belle of the world crew, see? No? Wake up, that's a story dress. That extra material tells a story, and somebody on world crews would be lonesome enough to want to hear it.
She bit close her last words. She had talked too much for her. And Abe found it difficult to gather from her serious set face that she had spoken at all.
With an effort, he drew himself up to a posture that looked as if he were standing up while he was sitting down.
"The afternoon you took me to that funny ball, you know, Saint-Geneviève's," he began.
"I remember. It was fun, wasn't it?"
"No fun for me. I haven't had fun seeing you this time. I'm tired of you both, but it doesn't show because you're even more tired of me. You know what I mean? If I had any enthusiasm, I'd go on to new people."
There was a rough nap on Nicole's velvet gloves as she slapped him back.
"Seems rather foolish to be unpleasant, Abe. Anyhow, you don't mean that. I can't see why you've given up about everything."
Abe considered, trying hard not to cough or blow his nose.
"I suppose I got bored. And then it was such a long way to go back in order to get anywhere."
Often a man can play the helpless child in front of a woman, but he can almost never bring it off when he feels most like a helpless child.
"No excuse for it," Nicole said crisply.
Abe was feeling worse every minute. He could think of nothing but disagreeable and sheerly nervous remarks. Nicole thought that the correct attitude for her was to sit staring straight ahead, hands in her lap. For a while there was no communication between them. Each was racing away from the other, breathing only insofar as there was blue space ahead, a sky not seen by the other. Unlike lovers, they possessed no past. Unlike man and wife, they possessed no future. Yet up to this morning, Nicole had liked Abe better than anyone except Dick. And he had been heavy, belly frightened with love for her for years.
"Tired of women's worlds," he spoke up suddenly.
"Then why don't you make a world of your own?"
"Tired of friends. The thing is to have sycophants."
Nicole tried to force the minute hand around on the station clock, but...
"You agree?" he demanded.
"I am a woman, and my business is to hold things together."
"My business is to tear them apart."
"When you get drunk, you don't tear anything apart except yourself," she said, cold now, and frightened, and unconfident.
The station was filling, but no one she knew came. After a moment, her eyes fell gratefully on a tall girl with straw hair like a helmet who was dropping letters in the mail slot.
"A girl I have to speak to, Abe. Abe, wake up, you fool!"
Patiently, Abe followed her with his eyes. The woman turned in a startled way to greet Nicole, and Abe recognized her as someone he had seen around Paris. He took advantage of Nicole's absence to cough hard and retchingly into his handkerchief and to blow his nose loud. The morning was warmer, and his underwear was soaked with sweat. His fingers trembled so violently that it took 4 matches to light a cigarette. It seemed absolutely necessary to make his way into the buffet for a drink, but immediately Nicole returned.
"That was a mistake," she said with frosty humor. "After begging me to come and see her, she gave me a good snubbing. She looked at me as if I were rotted."
Excited, she did a little laugh, as with 2 fingers high in the scales.
"Let people come to you."
Abe recovered from a cigarette cough and remarked, "Trouble is, when you're sober, you don't want to see anybody. When you're tight, nobody wants to see you."
"Who, me?" Nicole laughed again. For some reason, the late encounter had cheered her.
"No, me."
"Speak for yourself. I like people, a lot of people. I like..."
Rosemary and Mary North came in sight, walking slowly and searching for Abe. And Nicole burst forth grossly with, "Hey, hi, hey," and laughed and waved the package of handkerchiefs she had bought for Abe. They stood in an uncomfortable little group, weighted down by Abe's gigantic presence. He lay athwart them like the wreck of a galleon, dominating with his presence his own weakness and self-indulgence, his narrowness and bitterness. All of them were conscious of the solemn dignity that flowed from him, of his achievement, fragmentary, suggestive, and surpassed. But they were frightened at his survivant will. Once a will to live, now become a will to die. Dick Diver came and brought with him a fine glowing surface, on which the three women sprang like monkeys with cries of relief, perching on his shoulders, on the beautiful crown of his hat or the gold head of his cane. Now, for a moment, they could disregard the spectacle of Abe's gigantic obscenity. Dick saw the situation quickly and grasped it quietly. He pulled them out of themselves into the station, making plain its wonders. Nearby, some Americans were saying goodbye in voices that mimicked the cadence of water running into a large old bathtub. Standing in the station, with Paris in back of them, it seemed as if they were vicariously leaning a little over the ocean, already undergoing a sea change, a shifting about of atoms to form the essential molecule of a new people.
This ends Disc 3.